We're just going to give it a shot. We're just going to do it. Welcome back in podcast 707, the Bob Davis Podcast's Unbounded Optimism, Exuberant Personality Disorder, Technology Revolution in the Trump Age. How's that for an SEO title? It's a lot to bite off in podcast 707. So we're going to talk about new technology a little bit in this podcast and burgeoning new technologies for business as well. And of course, back in the day, if you started a business, you probably had a cash register. And if people needed to give you checks, you work with a local bank, and that was pretty much it. These days, people are doing business through websites. People are doing payment processing in all kinds of different ways. And that's really what payment processing is. It's just, you know, it's the old guy standing in front of the cash register taking a payment. And I want to talk specifically to developers who develop websites for clients that maybe do e-commerce or clients that need to have payment processing taken care of. I want you to consider ReliaFund, because ReliaFund is a payment processor that has been providing integrated solutions to get payments cleared for more than two decades. They are great, and they will work with clients. I've talked to them about this. I've been hanging out with these guys, and they have worked with many clients to turn things around and get things up and running for them. And it's great because ReliaFund has no long-term contracts. They're secure. They're technology-focused. I use ReliaFund, and they're great. 866-243-5040. Why call them? Because you're going to talk to a human being. You know, developers like to use email, and developers like to use technology, but sometimes the human touch is really important. So call ReliaFund. You'll talk to Greg Lowry or Kevin Hill at 866-243-5040. They can help you solve your payment processing issues. You can also check them out online at ReliaFund.com, R-E-L-I-A, ReliaFund.com. Well, I'm going to jump right in with something that I have been thinking about for a while, because I've been hearing it for a while, and this is not a podcast about Trump, although I'm going to use the word Trump. These days, if you even say Trump, it ends up being a polarity thing, because the minute you say Trump, people think you're going to say one thing or another. I'm just anchoring this podcast in time, and I'm anchoring you in time when I say Trump. So I've been hearing it for a while, this unbridled enthusiasm and optimism among some people that the economy is now booming. Trump has fixed it, or he's going to fix it. He's going to show them all. And what does this involve? It involves trade protection for big industrial shoulders like steel and coal. It is a response to the populist taunt, "We don't make stuff anymore." Whether it's from your local Tea Party guy or center-left icons like former Labor Secretary Robert Reich in the Clinton administration, Trump's going to step in and shore everything up. Construction, manufacturing, mining, oil. People are going to go back to work at plants. It's all going to be great. And I don't know, maybe they need to hear these things, but there's also kind of a signal there. Maybe he's actually doing this. Maybe they need it. But there's also kind of a signal there, and the signal is really about symbolism, that we're going to get back to the broad shoulders of an era gone by. We're going to reintroduce so-called solid American values, the character and virtue of a distant time when things were easier to understand. And I'm not talking about Reagan. I'm talking about the 1950s. I'm talking about Eisenhower and the 1957 Cadillac Fleetwood and, big American houses, big American cars, big American dinner tables with mashed potatoes and steak. When people dressed up to travel and women wore white gloves and a man wore a suit and a man's word meant something, right? This is something I see everywhere. I see it in books like Road to Character by David Brooks. I see it in the unbridled optimism by some for a new future under a new president, because they just think it will be true. And it's not unusual. Same thing happened with Obama as well, just with a different group of political adherents. You know, you see this commentary that says that the economy is booming now that we're clearing away regulation, cutting taxes, and so on. Well, first of all, I don't want to concentrate too much on economics. We're not really doing those things, but economic podcasts are boring. People predicting the future are either positive or negative, and I don't see any reason to join the fray and position against this guy or that guy, because honestly, I don't know as much as some of these people, and honestly, I don't care, because I can't predict the future. I can't tell you what is going to happen. A bright future also for some might not be a bright future for others, just as the bright past for some was not necessarily the bright past for others. I'm just going to say this, and this is really the meat of the economic stuff. Recently, the Atlantic Federal Reserve, which is known for its bullish economic predictions, said that we were going to have 5.4% GDP growth in the first quarter of 2018, which we are nearing we speak. Just this week, the Atlanta Fed issued yet another report, which basically adjusted its exuberance, says that the U.S. economy may actually contract in the first quarter. So they're talking now about anywhere between 2 and 1.8% growth, which is more to the baseline, versus something like 2.3% in the fourth quarter, which has been revised down from early reports. So now suddenly they're predicting that the GDP growth in the first quarter won't be as good as in the fourth quarter. So reports that fueled Trump boosters of every variety running around saying the economy was booming, well, they may have been irrationally exuberant. And by the way, 2.4% GDP growth in this country is not a boom. It is not even really moderate growth. I'd say 3% plus, 3.1 would be moderate growth. Anything below that is moribund, I would say. In other words, if you figure inflation is 1.5% to 2%, then 2.4% GDP growth really is not that big of a deal. I would just say this, and I'm not saying that we aren't going to have growth. I'm not saying that 2.4% growth is not good or anything else. I'm just saying that, you know, during the election, I asked voters, especially those calling themselves conservatives, to think about what kind of policy they wanted in economics and in foreign policy, and to learn about those things so that they could put some intellectual meat and strengthen the bones of whatever policy ideas they came up with. And I've always been told, you know, in talk radio, you're not supposed to say policy because people don't like that word. But the fact was that people did not learn about those things. They did not delve into an objective study of economic or foreign policy. What they voted for was a return to what is comfortable for most of them, living in a big industrial northern city or a small rural town where things are simple. Dad was a farmer or worked at the plant. Mom stayed home. You watched your favorite TV show in black and white when it came on the TV set, which sat only in the living room. The phone was something that was used for specific communications. The United States made big, heavy things that were sold across the world. We lived in a bilateral world. It was us against the commies. Things were simple. Life was good. And now we're a year into a new administration of supposed conservatives who are spending more than the so-called liberals, pushing trade protection. And while supposedly looking at less regulation in banking and manufacturing and so forth, they're actually also talking about more regulation when it comes to tech companies and information companies like Google and Facebook and so forth, because we really have to watch out for them. So they have to be regulated. So how is it that we're against regulation if we're talking about regulating Google and Facebook, right? But we don't see that, because what we think of as regulation is regulation on banking or the Steel Administration or oil or big fill in the blank. And people don't think of big Apple or big Google or big Facebook, except some Republicans and some conservatives suddenly want to, you know, regulate these information companies because they're the new villains. So some questions. Does a Keynesian-inspired tax cut, in other words, deficit spending $1.7 trillion to provide a tax cut to some, is that a good thing? Trade protection, that is, tariffs applied to protect certain industries, pushing to spend hundreds of billions more for infrastructure, spending more in general, and especially for the military, talking war in Syria and Iran and possibly North Korea, Does this all work as a so-called laissez-faire or supply-side or quote-unquote conservative policy? Is it in line with conservative values? And I'm just going to ask that question because I don't see how it makes any sense. But I don't, and this is why I say that we are experiencing this this irrational optimism about what's going on. People say Trump doesn't care about conservative voters, that what he's trying to do is get the so-called marginal voter, the ones most susceptible to this idea that we're bringing back a simpler, more predictable age when this country was the undisputed leader in the world. Mom didn't have to work. Dad had a good union job at the plant for the rest of his life. You said the Pledge of Allegiance and sang the national anthem at the football game. The cars came pouring out of the plants. The trains were up and down the tracks with the cars and the trucks. It was the horn of plenty. You said the Pledge of Allegiance at the beginning of the school day and sang the national anthem at the football game, and things just weren't that complicated. And I would just simply ask people who, you know, who want to think of that sort of halcyon perfect age without even challenging whether it was perfect to begin with at the time, do you think that's going to work? And I'm going to leave it at that. Does this kind of approach promote more individual freedom and more innovation? And does it promote economic growth? And it might. Maybe the first quarter numbers are going to be great, but I wonder what is the definitive approach of certain members of a certain political party to the economic, foreign trade, and foreign policy problems we face. I don't hear much discussions that lay out the bones of that policy and then put meat on those bones. Moreover, what is our approach as people to tackling the challenges of the dawn of what is certainly a very new and very radical age? You know, this is something that I warned people about many, many times, and it fell on deaf ears because I kept saying, you know, President Trump is a trade protectionist. You're going to see tariffs. You're going to see all sorts of trade protection, and it's going to be an issue, especially if you are one of these companies that uses foreign manufacturing. And I will tell you again, with his desire to protect some of these really old sort of smokestack industries, it's going to have an effect. And a lot of these big companies or even small companies need to think about reshoring, at least to hedge their bets. And if you're thinking about doing that, then I want you to think about DepotStar. Call them today. Check out their website, DepotStar.com. Ask them for a quote on your project. DepotStar, D-E-P-O-T. DepotStar is American Design, Engineering, and Manufacturing. Visit them again at DepotStar.com or click on that DepotStar banner at the top of the page at thebobdavispodcasts.com. Yeah, the dawn of a radical new age. An age of unfamiliar and misunderstood things like artificial intelligence, drone delivery, the cloud, your digital personal record, robots that do everything from make burgers and farm, yes they do, to laying brick and building buildings and drilling for oil and algorithms and things that seem like sixth grade math class instead of the building blocks of the new reality. Because what I see is an entire generation of people who should be leading right now, and I'm talking about people in their 50s and 60s and early 70s, struggling to make sense of it. And basically, the way that they make sense of it is to go back to the paradigm that existed right before they became adults or right before they became sentient, you know, young, pre-adolescent, you know, 11, 12, 13 years old, telling everybody to look back to that earlier time in the 20th century or the mid-20th century for the answers, and that this is where we have to be. And by the way, this is not something that I'm making up. I'm seeing this and hearing this everywhere. You know, what's wrong with this new group of people? We basically are seeing a generation of baby boomers who tore down the constructs of the mid-20th century that sent them to Vietnam. And suddenly in their old age, they're pointing to people like George C. Marshall and Eisenhower or Roosevelt and other people of that period of time who played a part in ruining their parents' and grandparents' economy and sending their grandparents and parents to war. And the villains of this supposedly moral construct are the young adults that they have conveniently labeled their children and their grandchildren, the generational people, the generational titles that they've given them, things like millennial and Gen Z, forgetting for a moment the venerable Gen X. Those kids and their cell phones, those kids and their devices, they can't get away from those screens, the electronic devices. They're ruining our lives. They focus too much on themselves. They're selfish. They're children, snowflake, man buns, and so forth and so on. And what we need to do is get back to a time when broad shoulders did something real. We actually made things. They made steel. They built houses. And we need new roads and bridges now and walls. And we need to make sure these new people coming into this country think a certain way. And we need to think about dedicating people to principles higher than the individual, to sacrifice for each other in the country and all these important institutions, and rebuilding these institutions. Yeah, and I hear it all the time, that, and I hear it from this baby boom and just ahead of the baby boom generation. I don't hear it from grandparents necessarily. I hear it from people who are, I mean, I'm talking about the people that are probably dead now, the generation that actually preceded the World War II generation. I'm going to talk about that in a second. This is a certain demographic of people, and many of them the so-called marginal voters. One problem with all this is that across the world, and you know this, a new information technology revolution is uprooting the very foundation and every foundation of every institution in the world. It is challenging the roots of every major social and governmental and business concept everywhere. And it's been doing this for a while, but it's really starting to gather speed. And I'm talking about, you know, churches and faiths in general, despite the growth of fundamentalism, and maybe because the growth of certain kinds of fundamentalism prove that they're being, that the traditional, churches and the traditional institutions of faith and spirit are being challenged. Challenging nation states, whether it is the promotion of new, you know, micronations or breakaway nations, Brexit and so forth, as well as businesses of all kinds. We've all seen businesses that used to be powerful become sclerotic and weak and disrupted because of this technology revolution. It's become something that we all know, except now it's starting to gather steam and really challenge and disrupt the institutions that people thought were immune to this thing. And what is at stake is the values, all the values of the old age. It isn't generational, it's monumental. This isn't something that's happening because the young people are playing with their portable devices or on screens. It is a monumental human change, a cyclone of change from every angle that is only just beginning. As I have said in previous podcasts, this is the cold blue dawn of this incredible revolution that no one is going to be able to run away from. It gives unprecedented power to the individual, and at the same time, it gives unprecedented power to the aggregators of information and the clouds and the people that control the servers and the innovators and applications in this new technology realm, whatever they are, because the economy of scale is so massive. Because, for example, if you invented DOS, if you invented the iPhone, if you invented the algorithm that provides, iTunes or something, to be prosaic about it, the economy of scale is massive. So all of a sudden, these companies and people that were part of the first blush of this technology have tremendous economic power, even if those companies really are vulnerable and highly unstable at the heart. It's very interesting to me that suddenly we have a president and we have people who think that the enemy that used to be big steel and big coal and big oil has to be protected suddenly. You know, that the industrialist, the manufacturer that used to be evil is suddenly the aggrieved the aggrieved person in this new world. Suddenly, the new evil is Amazon. The new evil is, companies that have taken advantage of the economies of scale like Walmart or social media applications, which may or may not last. At the turn of the century in this country, there were, let's just say in 1920, there were many, many different car companies. And today there aren't that many. But, in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, the villain was always an industrialist in the big limousine. Today, it's the guy that runs some tech company. And now, of course, we hear about all of these values that we have to conform to if there is to be any hope. And we hear it from this older generation, that suddenly now this is a generation that didn't conform, wants everybody to conform to the collective and the greater cause over the individual. But all the values and institutions of the old world are burning down. So what is there to conform to if they're all falling apart? Or, some of these institutions have been proven to be corrupt for a long, long time, even during those periods of time when people lived in the sort of haze of the 1950s, when you put gauze over the camera and you have the perfect 1957 Chevys and 1958 Buicks going up and down the street, and the rock and roll was playing, and everybody, oh, it's such a great time, and things were so great back in the 1950s, except the 1950s weren't that great. there were a lot of problems in the 1950s. People lived in fear of a lot of things. They had grown up in economic despair, and then they went into the greatest war in history, which was by no means guaranteed in terms of victory. And then after that, we went into this nuclear age that no one was prepared to deal with. So the 1950s weren't the 1950s that Hollywood has portrayed, and it wasn't the 1950s for certain kinds of people in this country who struggled for a lot of other reasons that I don't have time to get into here. But yet, we return to this time when, we lived in this incredible age when the 1960 Chrysler Imperial, was just this queen of the road going down the street. And it's a theme that I often return to in these podcasts because, honestly, I can't get away from it. Everything I read now suggests to me that we don't, and we aren't planning, thinking, and adjusting our thinking to new institutions based on new ideas, based on new building blocks. And if you're of a certain age, it's difficult because you have to allow the old way of thinking to be washed away and a new way of thinking to come into play. And then you have to really think about philosophic values and how do you incorporate certain values that are important to you into this new technology if you don't want to be washed away, literally. And I think there's a lot of people that just quit. They just decide they're going to quit and they're going to die. They're going to go away and they're going to – or they're just going to be really, just go to seed. And that's what I mean by die. And then, of course, this generation eventually will pass away. Ask yourself this. What happens if new biotech comes up with an effective anti- or reverse aging drug? What would it be like if you were 52 years old and you could reverse your age to 30 and live for another 150 years? How would you change your approach to life? What would you do with your life? What happens if, biotech or whatever comes up with a drug that ends all of the terminal diseases, whether it is heart disease or cancer or, Alzheimer's, of all of those things? What happens when, and it is an issue of when actually, when machines plant and tend crops, which they are already, testing and doing, build houses, which they do, and manufacture goods of all kinds, it's not just robotics, it's artificial intelligence and it's, information tech at all that is really revolutionizing manufacturing. So when somebody goes out and says, we're going to help manufacturing, it doesn't necessarily mean that millions of people are going to suddenly start working at the steel plant. When money, is either metal or exists in a database, how does that change things? And that is coming. When an inexhaustible and cheap power source ends any dependence on energy resources and powers cities with very little energy being expended to do that, that's going to happen. What happens when more and more powerful processors unlock the secrets of physics that make atomic physics look like child's play? And I'm talking about the atomic physics of the 1930s and 40s that gave us the atomic bomb. How will we cope with things like flying cars and drones and driverless vehicles and extremely, you know, functional robots and information systems that do things like allow remote surgery and other medical treatments, and also can be applied to weaponry. How do we handle all that? And this is also asymmetric, meaning that it comes from many different directions and it's unpredictable in its outcome. So we're talking about a new world with a lot of promise. We're talking about an asymmetric world that doesn't work well with symmetric kinds of institutions, churches and governments and things of that nature. And yet we keep talking about shoring up these institutions because we think they're important. Well, if they can't survive and if they're failing anyway, why are they important? You know, there's a whole bunch of these, what, you know, to people talking about putting farms in mile-high buildings to make organic, you know, basil or things that people, you know, all these different things. What happens when people can retire to floating cities in oceans, you know, that operate on their own currency, or you know, be able to retire to other countries that are and they're already doing this. I mean, a lot of people are retiring to places like Costa Rica and Panama and so forth. I could go on and on with this stuff, but really, I'm asking, what happens to these institutions? Certain people think we need to strengthen. And if you look at it from this point of view, what kind of political system do we have and what kind of world are we trying to hang on to, especially if you're a marginal, so-called marginal voter, where you're the kind of person that says, I really don't know what's going on, but I think Trump's great. Why? And then when you ask people this, or they when they used to say, I think Obama's great, and you'd ask them why, they couldn't tell you because they're not informed. They just think with an emotional perspective. And really, in that kind of an environment these days, we're really susceptible to all kinds of delusions that just roll through the population like wildfire, because people are actually less informed because they don't want to know. They're putting their head in the sand because they can't understand the new world. And what's happening in this is that these institutions that we have depended on that are really landmarks, so that we can negotiate the world, so that we can navigate in this world, these institutions are clearly dying because the people that support them are clinging to the past. They're not being able to be adaptable, and some of them will not be adaptable. This is not a comment about your faith. This is not a comment about, you know, people say, well, this is, you know, this is timeless, these things. But what isn't timeless is this increasing desire that people have, and I don't care what part of the political spectrum from there on, this increasing desire that people have to say, you have to think this way, and you should do this, and you should do that. And so I'm going to say it again, because I think it's really, really important. There is one value, and that value is individual freedom, the freedom to innovate, the freedom to have an opinion, the freedom to change, the freedom for everybody to be whatever they want, the freedom to keep the money you earn and the property you own, the freedom to be left alone, the freedom to set the course that you want to set in your life and not have to worry about people stopping you because you said something, or stopping you because you thought something, or stopping you because you're doing something that's unorthodox. And I'm going to tell you, I see what's happening in the news every day, and I see the polarity of the right and the polarity of the left, and not just in the United States. And I think I really have begun to believe they are all completely lost. And the result of this is that they're all going to be swept away because they're lost. The only question is what is going to be put in place of these institutions. And here's the thing. We think of this stuff as happening gradually, but my experience with disruption is it happens gradually and then, boom, it happens suddenly. And, you know, you're shocked at the disruption. You're shocked at the results of the disruption because an industry suddenly goes bankrupt. An entire industry is over with. An entire industry is on the blocks and praying and asking for help from the government. And it won't be too long before the institution of government itself is swept away, and we're going to have to figure out what to put in its place. And if we don't, things are not going to be good. So people need to not be thinking about Trump and not be thinking about Republicans and Democrats. They've got to be thinking, I think, about what we're going to do when these institutions are swept away, because that's – we're going to be the generation. If you're alive in the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, this is the generation in the world that is going to have to figure out what is going to be put in the place of these institutions that are failing massively. What values in the new world are going to be preeminent and predominant? And what is going to be our role in creating those values? Because it is coming, and it is coming fast. Yeah, so this is the kind of stuff I think about, and I got to get it out every now and then. You know, this will probably not be a big podcast, but I love it. This is the kind of podcast I love. And, you know, if it's a small podcast, I just want to say I really, really appreciate those of you who listen to the Bob Davis podcasts in all the many places and sources from which it flows. Stitcher.com, iTunes, TuneIn, BlogTalkRadio.com, Google Play, right off the page at thebobdavispodcast.com with the streaming, or actually listening to the podcast right off the page. And I do appreciate the likes and the shares and the favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter, and for your donations for the Bob Davis Podcasts at thebobdavispodcast.com. They do make a huge difference. Thanks for listening to Podcast 707.